This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to No Lies Radio.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, back after a two-week absence while I was in Tehran. Yes, that's right, I was in Tehran, Iran. The internet wasn't great at my hotel, so there was no question of trying to do live radio from there. I was at the New Horizons Conference, which is organized by some NGO folks over there who are interested in bringing together the most off the charts, outside the box, free thinkers from all over the world to come to a place where you don't have to worry about being arrested if you say that only 5,999,999 people, or Jewish people or what have you, were killed in the Nazi Holocaust. That can get you locked up in Germany. And if you talk about 9/11, you might just get fired from your job at an American university. I learned that the hard way. Over in Tehran, however, they do have a little free speech, and so people can say all that stuff and more. So we had a great time over there. It's good to be back. And tonight I'm going to be talking to a couple of people on the front line, somewhat different front line. Second hour, we're going to bring on Les Jamison. Les Jamison is a 9/11 truth activist from way back. I met him back in 2005, I think, and he's been doing New York 9/11 truth activism since even before that. He was with New York 9/11 truth, and now he is organizing the information activism at the 9/11 Museum in New York City. If you go to that museum, you may find people outside handing you pamphlets about the real story of 9/11, the alternative guide to the 9/11 Museum. Well, that would be Les Jamison. He's organizing that, and he's going to come on in the second hour to talk about it. First hour, we're going to interview a whistleblower, and this is somebody I don't know a whole lot about, just looked at his history a little bit recently, and wow, it looks really interesting. My guest here in the first hour is Scott Bennett. Scott Bennett is a U.S. Army psychological warfare officer from the 11th Psychological Operations Battalion, the Civil Affairs Psychological Operations Command. He's a global psychological warfare and counterterrorism analyst, and he's become a whistleblower, saying a lot of the same kinds of things that people like me have been saying, only he's seen it from the inside, so let's hear about it. Welcome, Scott Bennett. How are you? Hello, Scott. I think we have Scott here somewhere. Let me see. Is there anything I can do to make sure that we can hear him? I'm going to say hello, Scott. Here, typing, hello, Scott. I'm not getting any volume. So let me see if there's a reason for that I can determine. Nah, not yet. Maybe they're playing some kind of psychological operations trick on us. Okay, let me try and bring him on again here. So we had some kind of issue. Okay. Oh, let me see here. Okay, we should have him on. I'm going to ask him if he has a microphone. And maybe Scott, you need to either plug in your microphone or you need to call up the NSA and tell them to knock it off. One or the other. Not sure which.
Can you hear me okay?
Hey, there you go. Hey, Scott, welcome. How are you?
So, hey, thank you very much. I was trying to get this all set up and calls are coming and stopping. So.
You know, we got you. And I wish I could bring you on television, but unfortunately I can't. This is just audio. So if you want to turn off your visual, then we'll get even better sound quality.
Okay.
All right.
Bear with 1 minute there.
Yeah, no big hurry. Well, I was just telling the listeners about your background, and it's fascinating. You know, the other U.S. Army psychological operations guy that I got to know was Captain Eric May. I met him back in 2005, and he had some fascinating insights into what's really going on behind the scenes. But when I saw you, you know, it looks like you've been a whistleblower for a few years now. And I don't know a whole lot about your background, so maybe you could go over how you got into the Army Psychological Operations and then what brought you to become a whistleblower.
Yeah, certainly. Well, you can hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
Great. Well, let me just first start out with the statement. I won't be discussing anything that violates my security clearance, my oath as an officer. I had a TSSCI clearance, so I've always got to be careful in making those statements in the beginning so that no one can cobble together any sort of phantom charge that I've been in any way disloyal or disrespectful. So I'll share with you what I can and what was reviewed to me, and I looked at your questions and subject matter, and everything looked good. So with that said, my origins in psychological warfare, and I prefer to call it psychological warfare, not operations, because that's more of the historical training that we were led to engage the discipline with. You're trying to influence the minds and actions of enemy combatants who are you're put to war against. I had joined the psychological operations community through my Colonel Jeff Jones, who was the 4th Pod Commander at Fort Bragg, an Army officer, very distinguished man. In fact, knew a lot of the people that you were addressing, Lieutenant Colonel Cannon, whose Earth Brigade is the subject matter which was used in the Men Do Stare at Goats film, and some of that was laughable, but a lot of it is certainly applicable. I had had a background in advertising, and I did a lot of foreign direct investment analysis for USAID, which works, of course, for CIA in European countries. And I did a lot of Islamic theory analysis, Islamic personality profile, and a lot of developing psychological warfare techniques that articulate economic principles rather than the religious antagonisms, and had proceeded up that course until I went in to pursue my doctorate at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. when I finished my master's, then went into the Bush administration after the Heritage Foundation, and then went into Booz Allen Hamilton, and soon after that was given a direct commission in the Army after various meetings with people that I knew at the Pentagon, and really after Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and General Myers had said to me in a meeting when I had challenged them on our failures in psychological warfare, and General Myers had said to me, yeah, we're getting a D+ in that area. And Secretary Rumsfeld said, well, those of you who can add something with your background, you should enlist and empower our military, you know, with your skills. So I did that upon his recommendation, and went into the psychological warfare community in the military, and that's how the adventure started.
Wow, Myers and Rumsfeld, those are two people high up on my list of suspects in the crime of the century.
Yeah, well, I've got a video of it, so I can back up everything. Everything is documented and videoed, but I would share a lot of your assessment. I've followed a lot of your writing and your work, and I think it's very scholarly and it's very penetrating, and it's right on the money with regards to truth.
Well, I appreciate that. So you were on the inside. You're right there in the belly of the beast. Tell us a little bit about what you discovered and how things, you know, reached the point that you felt you had to become a whistleblower.
Well, you know, there are two camps of people who go into the military, from a psychological warfare, intelligence, special operations, type. When I talk about the military, I talk about just really only special operations, special forces, Green Berets, SEALs, psychological warfare analysts, to some degree, public affairs officers and stuff, civil affairs, but really, the people who go into special operations have a speciality. They have a background. They have a profession. They have an education. They have years of experience that they are recruited out of civilian life to come into the military to complement and empower the military's capabilities. And that was what attracted me, and it's what I was recruited for. My background had been, without going into exhaustive detail, I had worked in advertising, I'd worked in Hollywood, I'd worked in comic book writing, I'd worked in creative writing, and then pursued political activities in Washington. I'd left California and worked for 10 years in public policy and think tanks and Capitol Hill and the Bush administration, and it really had a lot of interagency experience with the intelligence agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the State Department, National Counterterrorism Center, everybody under the sun that dealt with, you know, combating terrorists. And I had joined because I wanted to get in and help develop ideas that followed advertising models, which advertising really is the foundation of psychological operations.
I think advertising is the psychological war of the century.
It really is, and it, you know, you can do a lot of noble good things. You can do a lot of noble messaging and things that are positive, or you can do incredibly destructive, foolish things. And I think the latter is what we've unfortunately fallen into or been led into with regards to the PSYOP campaign of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I had been groomed to come in, and I drank the Kool-Aid, and I jumped right in 2008, and I was supposed to come in as a captain and go through all sorts of interesting experiences. I very quickly began to discover that, you know, some of the best soldiers are those who are under the rank of major. Once soldiers started hitting the ranks of major and above, then it became a career ladder. Then it became money game. Then it became how do I advance the mission on paper and preserve my status and elevate myself up the next assignment in military ranks, rather than how do I exploit opportunities? How do I develop asymmetric capabilities? How do I harness the maverick, unorthodox impulses, which are always successful in history for winning wars, that instinct starts to die after the rank of major. So I quickly found everyone above the rank of major really wasn't interested in winning the war, and everyone under the rank of major became either frustrated or was pushed out. And if you didn't allow them to push you out and you didn't melt down in frustration, you were very quickly taken out by force, which was what they did to me in a cobbled up, silly prosecution by a Department of Justice prosecutor in Florida for a paperwork error on a base housing form, which is still in appeal. And I'm confident at the end of the day, when it gets heard and gets exposed, it'll all be reversed. But
That sounds incredibly rinky-dink. I mean, talk about, you know, there are these outrageous crimes being committed all the time, you know, drug smuggling and false flag terrorism and assassinations and all sorts of things like that. And here they're making a federal case out of, a mistake on a housing form.
Well, you know, I had been targeted because of my background in the Bush administration and heritage and various conservative ribbons on my chest, and they thought I was going to be an easy target. I was, in fact, told by one of my superior officers, Bennett, you've stirred the pot and you won't stop stirring it. That's why they're coming after you. And I always came back to the thought, what do the American people want in their special operations soldiers? Do they want followers and people that don't press the envelope and don't think outside the box and just look for orders to be given and taken? Never mind the degree of intelligence or maliciousness behind the people giving those orders. Or do they want soldiers who are coming into the fight to be creative and generate an end to the conflict, so that America can go back to a level of peace? And
now that's a concept.
Yeah.
The way things are going, it looks like they've got an endless Orwellian war plan for us.
Well, I would agree with you. The endless Orwellian war, you know, plan is either blind ignorance and stupidity, or you're intentionally trying to flatten the sandcastles of the Middle East countries to, one, prosper by re-erecting them through defense contractors like Booz Allen Hamilton, SAIC, and others, or you're just going in to try and generate such a conflict between the Sunni and the Shia and the Alawite and the sub-tribes. That's a concept, concept people really don't even get into, is that you have a myriad of sub-tribes and clans that make it absolutely impossible for them to sing Kumbaya and buy the world a Coke and grab hands in a big circle and say, now we're all Middle Eastern Muslims, let's get along with the United States as one big caliphate. That'll never happen because each tribe in each country, from Jordan to the Syrians to the Saudis to the Iraqis to the Iranians, they all hate and despise each other because of their different echelons and connections to Muhammad and the mythology of Islam. And it goes back 2,000 years. Now, the military gets a lot of this. We were trained in a lot of this in psychological warfare. But the funny thing I kept coming back was the lack of really enthusiasm and will to get in and to change the mind of the Muslim personality. They really weren't interested in doing that, which leads me to believe that they just didn't want to, because there were extraordinary people like Captain May who were extraordinarily competent and could easily have done it. But they were prevented from doing it, as I was prevented from doing it.
In what way do you think that changing minds in the Islamic world would be helpful to the U.S.? My take on it is that there's really nothing that needs to be changed. It's the U.S. policy that needs to change, and the biggest change is to stop supporting genocide in occupied Palestine.
Well, I would agree. You can't change minds. You have to allow people to change on their own evolution. One of my professors at Catholic University wrote a profoundly prophetic book, America the Virtuous, in 2003. Dr. Klaus Rinn, very strong conservative, had been at Heritage and elsewhere, but he was attacking the neocons and this whole inverse religiosity of the inverse communism, which is the neocon agenda to sprinkle the fairy dust of capitalism and democratic institutions throughout the Middle East, and suddenly these people will be civilized. Suddenly these people will get along. Suddenly they will fall in love with Israel, and quote, democracies won't attack each other and everything will be peaceful. And that, in his book in 2003, he said that is absolutely impossible because we haven't taken into consideration the variable of culture. And within culture, that big bubble, you've got myth, you've got poetry, you've got spirituality, you've got human religious relationships, marriage structures, you've got internal institutions of governance, you've got the rule of law, specifically the rule of Sharia law versus, our non-religious law. A lot of things that we took for granted are totally alien concepts to the Middle Eastern mind. And when you try and forcibly impregnate the Middle Eastern mind with some of these concepts, you get the same reaction as a person who has similarly tried to be forcibly raped. They kick back, they scream, they scratch, they rage, they grab a gun, they grab a sword, they react with hysterical rage, quite understandably. And we seem to have a lot of policy people in the United States, from Panetta, who was a Booz Allen man, incidentally, to McConnell, who's a Booz Allen Hamilton man, to others high up, that just don't seem to be understanding this, don't seem to be getting it.
Let me stop you for a moment there, because my take on it here is that I think the real policy in terms of the strategic objectives that are being pursued by people who understand them are not to bring any kind of democracy or freedom or capitalism, et cetera, to the Middle East. On the contrary, actual democracy, meaning more, I don't think there's any such thing as pure democracy, but there are relative degrees of the people having a voice in the decisions of their society. And, in the most democratic society, the people still have a pretty small voice. It's always elites that have the major voice. But in any case, the people of the Middle East are not going to be doing anything nice for American strategic objectives if they are ever empowered. On the contrary, the people of the Middle East are adamant that they want the genocide in occupied Palestine stopped. They want to liberate Palestine, and they want to be paid a fair price for their oil. And so if the people of the Middle East are ever empowered, Israel is gone, and the U.S. is going to be paying a heck of a lot more money for oil. So I think our whole policy has been actually geared towards preventing any kind of empowerment of the people. And in countries where the people are to some extent empowered, such as Iran, we're not happy with that.
Well, I would agree. I think we've been on you judge people and governments by their acts, and the acts that we've been taken have led to an increased hostility against all things, not only American, but Western. You have the amalgamation and the consolidation of everything Muslim into a one camp, which is the ISIS, ISIL, whereas before, you had all these disparate groups that were in sort of like the clans of Scotland. You had, various clans that disliked the British king, the English king, but also disliked each other. Well, now we're allowing and encouraging all these Muslim clans and groups to gather and consolidate in the ISIS geography look at America as the aggressive crusader force. So I would agree.
Most Muslims are not supporting ISIL. On the contrary, the polls show that their support is, I believe it's lower. Al-Qaeda's support is something like 15% in the global Muslim population. I think ISIL is less. I think it's like closer to 10%.
Yeah.
So it's not that they're getting support. There's not a single reputable Muslim scholar, leader, or any Muslim country that openly supports this group. On the contrary, they're loathed and detested by virtually all Muslims, but they're still doing pretty well on the ground. I think they've got Saddam Hussein's loyalists working for them, and that's helped a lot. And then they've also been armed and trained by the deep state and our Gulf allies and friends, people in Turkey, and this criminal side of the military intelligence complex that you may have encountered. Actually, I want to get into that, about how you discovered that there was some funny business going on financing ISIL and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. My background in the finance analysis realm was as a terrorist threat finance analyst for U.S. Central Command for the Joint Interagency Operations Center, in which I was at the center of the spider web of all U.S. and Five Eye intelligence agencies that specifically dealt with the terrorist financing. The money, the banks, the gold, the various commodities, the everything down the line, from the couriers to the hawalas and the distribution centers and the countries and their political echelons that were, tacitly supporting a lot of the flow and the money sort to radical individuals and radical groups, mainly because they were trying to avoid any sort of upheaval in their own country. So you had a lot of money that were going to these banks that were then in turn being funneled out to bad guys. I had discovered a lot of this and was writing reports and recommendations from a PSYOP level as a psychological warfare person. How are we handling the banking financial dimension? Are we putting out messaging through our embassies and to banking institutions to try and stop the money? If you stop the money flow that is getting to the ISIS type groups, the black flag type groups, they'll soon dissipate and they'll, give up the sword in order to feed their stomach in some capacity. And soon after that, I had been targeted and for removal and some other negative effects.
Now that's interesting. It makes you almost suspect that somebody doesn't want anyone to stop that funding.
Well, that's exactly precise, and you're right on the money. And you come to some of these things, and I'll admit it, with a certain naivety and a certain patriotism and love of country and love of the military that helps keep that smoke across your eyes, where you don't want to look at some of the quote conspiracy theories and which really in the end are the true theories and the accurate depictions of fact and the accurate analysis of evidence of everything from the World Trade Towers to the Pentagon attack to some of the other black flag operations. You don't want to believe that in the beginning, but the more evidence and science that you analyze, the more you come to the common sense understanding that what has been branded as conspiracy theory is really the true theory.
How many people at, you know, in the places where you were working in, you know, special ops and the Army and the policy institutes actually understand this?
There is again, two schools, those who kind of shake their head and just get along and want to continue the career path and really don't take into consideration the long-term 25, 50-year forecast of how this will affect our national identity and our national security and role in the world. And then there are those who recognize that the horses are running wild and that there is a cliff in the distance that some people just don't want to look towards. And those who are looking and see the cliff, who try and change direction and try and get attention and try and engage in intellectual, intelligent analytical discussion on this, they're shut down or they're completely ignored. The military has a bureaucracy that doesn't want to engage a lot of this stuff. But there are a lot of people I met right after, I mean, in 2008 when we had been in the war a little bit, a lot of the special operations people knew there were serious fissures and disconnects and suspicious material that was bubbling up to the surface, and they were getting out. A lot of them were very depressed because they could see that this was a false flag operation from the very get-go that could very quickly turn against the United States. And I think you see some of that happening in the last few years with the strengthening and the assembling of the BRIC nations and the Economic Development Pact that they've established. Quite rightly, in a lot of respects, you see that consolidation of the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa nations, and you see that, you know, weakening of the United States, and then you see that weakening of the United States furthered by its NSA, CIA revelations of completely unconstitutional and inappropriate behaviors, and then you see similar flag operations such as the shoot down of the MH17. Plane over Ukraine right after Putin was flying back. You see a lot of suspicious stuff, and it's almost like those in the military and the intelligence agencies of the United States are hanging on by their fingernails to try and get a second wind into the American empire understanding. And I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's very damaging. What's most troubling to me from a PSYOP perspective is the poll that was done in Russia, where it indicates something like 88% or higher of Russians see America as Russia's prime enemy. And that's only developed in the last 3 years.
Yeah, and that's from shooting ourselves in the foot. I mean, there was no reason we had to do that.
Absolutely.
No, I just saw a poll recently, which I had somehow missed for a couple of years. It was taken, I think, 2 or 3 years ago in China, showing that more than 2/3 of the Chinese people don't believe the official story of 9/11. So that goes with 80% of Muslims around the world. And in Russia, I'm not quite sure what the numbers would be, but I think it would be similar. You know, when they were having that problem between South Ossetia and Georgia, the Russian government put a big 9/11 truth special on primetime TV and showed it to over 50 million Russians.
Yeah.
And they brought on General Ivashov, I think it was, who said something like, well, you know, at first when 9/11 was happening, we were scared that, you know, everybody went on high alert and missiles were all loaded and locked and loaded, ready to go. And then, you know, from our satellites, we realized that this was an internal problem. So basically, the Russian government told their people that 9/11 was an inside job on primetime television to 50 million people at that point. And you know, I think from a psychological operations perspective, this 9/11 false flag op has been a complete disaster. It's, you know, it's hollowed out legitimacy in the U.S., and it's hollowed out legitimacy for the U.S. on the world stage. You know, I think the only way we're, from a PSYOPs perspective, we're ever going to get our credibility back is to expose it and prosecute these people.
Well, I agree 100%. I was just inclining in that direction as well. You very easily could have a revisitation of the, quote, Nuremberg-like trials in the United States. The Nuremberg trials where you have Rumsfeld and Meyer and Bush and Condoleezza Rice and various other people in the, Armitage, Dick Armitage is a huge one. All of those people brought, and the Congress, the members of Congress who have ignored a lot of this material, brought in a certain court environment within the United States and brought to justice and questioned. The 9/11 Truth Commission, please, that's propaganda from the very beginning. When you look at a lot of these experts who've come and developed a lot of this material and the evidence, the 9/11 engineers and architects and scientists and physicists and military officers, it shows you that the avalanche is coming. It's a slow avalanche, but it's coming, and it, like an avalanche, it will not be retarded. It will not be pushed back. It will only gain strength and momentum as more intelligent people quietly and gently and respectfully educate and enlighten other Americans in their churches, in their synagogues, in their mosques, in their country clubs, in their knitting groups, and begin to entertain the analysis of the facts. Let's just look at the science of a lot of these issues and the circumstances. Let's not get into who did what. That comes in part two. The first thing is to analyze the sciences. Barbara Honegger and Susan Lindauer and a lot of others have done already. And once you get the science, then it's absolutely unavoidable to say, yes, there were explosions in the building that came from internal detonation devices and maybe other things. That leads us to believe, well, how did they get there and who did that and why was it done? And then you begin to analyze the money trail of the $2.3 trillion that was missing. And that's where I sort of found myself being threaded in all of the same places and the same commands and the same work environments as a lot of these guys who've been closely connected with the 9/11 operations and the Patriot Act and the War on Terror. I mean, I was at the Heritage Foundation. I was in the Bush administration. I was in Booz Allen Hamilton. I was in the Pentagon. I was in various other interesting places. And the common denominator, which is just coming out now, that I've gotten out and finally am at a computer and able to get a lot of my material out to people, is the Dov Zakheim-Booz Allen Hamilton connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk about that a little bit. Dov Zakheim was the comptroller of the Pentagon at the time, leading right up to 9/11, and of course on September 10th, 2001, as you mentioned, Rumsfeld went on television and stated that the Pentagon had lost track of $2.3 trillion, which was about seven times its annual budget. That's a lot of money to lose track of. And the next day, 9/11 happens, it's wiped out of the headlines. That Dov Zakheim is kind of high up on everybody's list of suspects. So what did you learn about the money trail?
Well, all of my paperwork had Dov Zakheim's signatures all over it. And all of my paperwork I've sent to the Florida courts as part of my appeal of this entire silly case. So everything that I found and I had, I entered into the courts as material evidence. So it is open access public. I made sure that everything I had, because of what they did to me, was going to be thrown out and examined in a court of law. So they couldn't gag it. They couldn't cover it up. They couldn't sequester it. And Dov Zakheim was the Pentagon comptroller. After that, on May 5th, 2004, he went to the Booz Allen Hamilton defense contracting firm and, among other projects, headed up the money source, money contract operation for Booz Allen Hamilton at MacDill Air Force Base. Before he had went into the Pentagon, as you know well, he was CEO of Systems Process, or SPS, the company that did remote control plane technology in case of hijacking. Planes could be taken over from the ground and flown back down to the airport. Well, Dov Zakheim had been the CEO of that company that developed a lot of that technology. And a lot of that technology was also within the Booz Allen Hamilton technology sector in McLean, Virginia. So he had fingerprints over a lot of this stuff. And he had went to head up the terrorist financing operation in MacDill. I had been recruited into that team after I had worked at the State Department as Special Operations Command liaison officer, placed by Booz Allen Hamilton, Colonel Jones, where I saw every psychological warfare campaign that the United States was engaging in across the globe. I won't go into a lot of those materials, but I saw everything and I knew everything and I knew everybody who was doing everything. Every embassy and every military operation, every military command, every senior military commander, and every four and five eyes commander across the globe from year 2008 and a few years before and a few years after. So I knew everything that was going on in that discipline. When I was recruited out of that by Dov Zakheim and went down to MacDill, and again, I was not of the school of I'm going to join the war machine and get rich and get a, you know, fat house in McLean, Virginia, and get married and raise kids and just live a quiet parasitic life. I joined Booz Allen Hamilton and I joined the Army to get in, apply everything I knew and had to win a war and get out. That's the first antagonism that they don't like. But I had seen a lot of material, a lot of failures, a lot of opportunities in my terrorist finance school. And soon after that, I was removed, and Dov Zakheim was the one who removed me. He was the one who fired me. And I think he'll be one of the people that are brought to justice eventually. He left very quickly right after they took me out. He left Booz Allen Hamilton, and they got an attempt to, sort of quiet this issue down. It was most interesting to me, though. I thought in the beginning, I was told, keep quiet, don't make any noise, a lot of this will go away. And I thought the military was going to come in and totally make this go away. I thought it was, in honesty, I thought it was a testing of my abilities. And little did I know, they were really serious about prosecuting. None of my material, none of my witnesses, none of the evidence that I had was ever put in front of a court. And that was very suspicious to me. I was basically put on trial in a civilian jury about a military issue and not given any military counsel and, you know, not allowed to wear my uniform. It was amazing. And first time in the history of the United States that they've ever gotten away with doing this. And I think, of course, it'll be the last time. I think it'll be immediately reversed because the precedent is staggering. It's what they've done to me. If it's allowed to stand, it represents a death spike in the heart of a lot of our freedom and liberty and separation between military jurisdiction and civilian jurisdiction.
Now, can you throw in the inference that this prosecution, which seems frivolous or grossly exaggerated and being carried out in this bizarre way, is some kind of retaliation for your going after terrorist financiers?
Well, that was the beginning of it. They were hoping to remove me from the terrorist finance realm and contract, and they did that by inventing this false report, you know, the false paperwork error and silliness, and that was the initial thrust to get me out. But there was an interesting experience too that ties into it. Again, it's sort of an indicator of my personality. I was always looking to advance the military mission and be successful and deteriorate the Muslim terrorist aggression against us in a lot of respects. never mind getting into, well, are we fueling Muslim terrorism ourselves? Are we growing them? Are we training them? Are CIA operations developing them? Putting that to a side, I was specifically looking at who are the bad guys? What do they think? And what are they doing? And what can we do to weaken them? Well, I saw one thing that was inflaming them because I had a lot of access to their recruitment videos and their internet productions and their radio and everything that they were using to rally their Muslim believers to either give money or join as a jihadi foot soldier or suicide bomber. And a big thing that was happening was there was a press by the Obama administration, as you know, to change the don't ask, don't tell policy in the military. They were hell-bent on introducing the gay marriage issue into the military. And I had discussed a lot of this with my fellow PSYOP officers about how this was going to be utilized by the Muslim cleric religious establishment to generate money, cash, and foot soldiers. And there's a pure agreement that this was going to be very dangerous and damaging to our troops. And we basically had to know how to handle it properly. So I put a report out saying to my higher echelons at U.S. Civil Affairs Psychological Operations Command, a second POG commander named Colonel Burley, and my immediate Lieutenant Colonel Joel Droba at the 11th PSYOP Battalion. And I generated a report citing a lot of social science evidence and Muslim terrorism connections that this changing in policy would result in a lot of terrorist activities against us and recruitment and money and so forth. And it was 1 month after I submitted that that I was indicted by the Justice Department. 1 month. So I think they saw that as a trigger, and this guy's a round peg in a square hole. We thought he was going to be quiet and he wasn't going to rock the boat, but now he's throwing in a report that recommends, you know, that identifies the negativity of this policy. The significance of that is 2 years later, the Benghazi embassy assault had occurred, where they were lighting on fire the gasoline. They were using flyers, paper that had job advertisements by the Department of State endorsing and supporting homosexuality within its State Department. Now, aside from the American politics and how we view that, that is very different from how the religious clerical Muslim establishment views it.
And well, that, you know, I'm kind of surprised that that's a huge factor in actual attacks and, you know, jihad activity. I mean, I would have thought that it would be a factor in general negative views of the U.S.
That's what it was. That's exactly.
But those general negative views are one thing. And then the things that lead people to actually want to risk their lives to go out and commit violence or, you know, to do armed struggle, that's usually, it seems to me, I don't know, based on my experience, it's the people who blame the U.S. for, you know, murdering 500,000 Iraqi children, which Madeleine Albright admitted. And, you know, they look at Iraq today strewn with EU and, you know, children being born with two heads and, you know, complete disaster. Basically that, you know, as Chomsky and Volchek point out in their book on Western terrorism, you know, U.S. military and CIA interventions have killed 50 to 60 million people since World War II. So that's about 10 Holocaust worth of people. And everybody in the rest of the world knows this.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, sure, the homosexuality and these cultural issues contribute to a negative view overall. But I think it's the killing people that pisses people off. I mean, we're drone killing all these people. Every person that we kill with the drone, there's, you know, a bunch of relatives and friends that are not going to forget that. And I don't think you need to even bring in the cultural issues to see why there are so many people who want to do us harm.
Well, you're right. I agree with you 100%. This is not the thing that triggered the entire aggression in a lot of respects. It's just simply another straw on the camel's back that to some can be useful in rallying money and aggression, mainly because they see the U.S. through its CIA operations, as you've identified well, besides killing all sorts of people and launching drones against our people and our country, they are now looking to infect our country and our culture and our religion with their American, you know, values and the American, the common thread that you see in a lot of the communications in the Middle East, clerical, hardcore, Muslim personality is the attacks against the, quote, sexual degeneracy and the family degeneracy and the moral degeneracy. A lot of the pop culture that comes out of the American establishment in Hollywood and elsewhere, that is the poison that these clerics identify and identify as needed to be stopped at all costs. And that's what triggers a lot of these people to join the jihad and get all wound up and come against us.
And it probably ties in with the things like the drone issue, because I think that there's a connection, you know, between this image of the U.S. as a very degenerate society and the absolute and utter cowardice of people who are so afraid to risk their own lives that they kill you with remote control devices, you know, sitting in, you know, a room in Las Vegas playing video games and killing people. And now there's a study showing 49 out of 50 drone victims are innocent civilians. You know, they kill 50 innocent people for every so-called terrorist. And this just, you know, talk about bad psychological warfare. I mean, this makes the U.S. look really bad. And it ties together because, okay, we're sexually degenerate. Our morals are terrible and we're cowards. You know, we're murderous cowards. And no wonder, you know, I mean, what do we expect?
Yeah. You hit it on the head. The major failure from a psychological warfare perspective that we've suffered. Let's jump ahead really and look at the failure to fix this problem, which this war could have been over in 3 years at the most. I mean, once we stepped into it, once we kicked over the hornet's nest, which is why I jumped in, hey, we've kicked over a hornet's nest, and I want to make sure this war is ended properly so I can come home and live my life and live in my country. That's why I joined. So we kicked over the hornet's nest, and all sorts of hornets are flying around. Now, we've been embarking on this old, tired man with castrated imaginations and chain-smoking, divorced contractor in the Pentagon mentality of let's just employ all the military force, hammers against flies, and swat everything we can. We'll beat them down. We'll defeat them in drone strikes. We'll hurt them and crush them to the point where eventually they're going to give up and throw up their hands and say, okay, we're going to embrace American values. That will never, ever happen. They will die before that will ever happen. And in fact, when they have seven kids to our 1.1, they basically outnumber us, and they know that, and Europe knows that, and the United States, the intelligence people, should know that. So we're numerically in a problem environment. The PSYOP failure has been in the last 10 years, we had an opportunity at the very beginning to take 5-year-old boys, 10-year-old boys in 2001, 2002, 2003, and develop them into, quote, a pro-American, for sake of ease, a pro-American mentality, a pro-American personality. And I saw a little bit of this. They were bringing over Iraqi kids under the Bremer administration operations in 2005 and 6. But we
just
failed.
Just bringing the kids, but not their parents?
Just bringing in, well, they weren't children. They were a little bit older. They were in the late teens and 20s. But they failed to take these young kids, and as Rome would have done, as I think you see this in all the old ancient empire lessons, they take the cream of the crop of the youth, and they develop them into pro-empire-thinking individuals. And that's the model of success in the history of conquest. Well, if we're serious about conquest, then we should have done exactly the same thing, and we never have. Instead, we've let a generation of 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds now become 20, 25, 30-year-olds who have seen nothing but, as you've described well, America stepping in, killing people, launching drones, and causing a lot of chaos. So,
well, and also, I mean, if you're a Muslim, and you, whether you're an Iraqi young person who's brought to the U.S. or whether you live here, what have you, and you see that there's this war on Islam for no particular reason launched by this murderous false flag on 9/11, how are you going to really respect that empire that's done this? There's no way. It's not going
to
happen.
Right. We fail to softly persuade the Muslim mind through the instruments that they are most responsive to, and that is the seductive, the poetic, the very gentle, almost effeminate side of the Muslim personality, which predominates. If you've read the Arab Mind, is a good book on the psychological.
Well, I would beg to differ. I mean, that's basically an Israeli, that's a PSYOP manual, I think, in a kind of a bad sense. It's a typical, colonial thinking, where the colonizer has to always come up with an excuse to explain why, he has the right to dispossess the colonized. And so you come up with all of these kinds of patronizing, attempts to do it. But, I'm not sure that all of that kind of psychologizing really gets you anywhere, because in today's world, I don't think these imperial relations are possible anymore. We're in a world of many-to-many communication, not one-to-many. And so basically we could have a good relationship with the Muslim world. That would be easy. All we have to do is cut the Zionists loose, just dump them, and then have a respectful relationship with the oil-producing countries, cut them a deal of protection against India, China, Russia, whoever might invade, in return for a slightly better trade deal in terms of trade. And then there you go. You don't need to worry about the psychology. You don't need to worry about domination. You don't even need any military bases, or very few over there. But the problem, I think, is that we're stuck in this imperial mentality where we're using this kind of psychology. Oh, we have to, make these people imperial slaves and so on, and we have to convince them to like Israel. Give me a break. Palestine's been Islamically administered holy land ever since Islam existed. And when these Zionist, racist, genocidal lunatics invaded to basically slaughter and displace the people of Palestine, that was just never, ever going to be acceptable in a million years. So we have to admit that Zionist experiment has failed. If the Zionists themselves want to try and keep it going, let them, but not one penny from the United States should ever be going to support Israel. Any American Jew who tries to support Israel in any way needs to be deported or arrested, because that is a crime against humanity to be participating in that genocide. Once we change policy in that direction, we will not have any problem with the Islamic world.
Well, you have a lot of people in the military who would agree with you 100% that is exactly the trigger, the policy direction that needs to be followed. The big propaganda psyop that hits this country internally, the United States of America, the number one brain control that's been going on has been the equating of the Christian destiny with the Israeli Jewish destiny. It's been pounded from the pulpits. It's been mistaught throughout the last 50 years that the United States Christian, the American Western Christian identity has got to give complete protection and support for all things that the state of Israel, does and chooses. Under the whoever, protects and blesses the Jews will be blessed and protected. And that is so ingrained in the psyche of the American mind that you have the Midwest and certain parts in this country that are almost kamikaze in their blind loyalty to all things that are done by the Israeli state and its various operations. And that's led to this sense of invulnerability and they cover up and can spin some of their operations well. But when you have the American political leadership on Capitol Hill giving complete endorsement and really advancing a lot of their agenda and their policies through the halls of Congress, through our laws, through the Patriot Act, when you have laws in the United States that allow dual citizenship and you can vote in Israeli elections as well as U.S. elections, you've got a real dirty political world. My experience with the dirty political world, of course, is I wrote over 100 congressmen and senators about my PSYOP threat finance discoveries with Brad Birkenfeld, the Union Bank of Switzerland, its terrorist finance connections, and not one single congressman or senator responded or did anything. The only one who responded lukewarmly was Senator Rand Paul. Now, I wrote everyone in the military commands. I've got a letter that I'm happy to read you that, you know, you can use at your convenience and edit, but it was...
Yeah, we might need the short version because I think we're just about at the end of the hour.
Yeah, I'll read you...
In fact, we are at the end of the hour. That's the music. I'm sorry. But if you send it to me, I could post it at the radio blog.
I will be happy to do that because it talks about the PSYOP terrorist dimensions and the military did nothing with this.
Okay, yeah, why don't you send that to me and I will publish it. And people can find that by way of truthjihad.com. Go to the radio link. Well, thank you, Scott Bennett, PSYOP's officer and whistleblowing truth teller. I appreciate your efforts, and I look forward to talking again.
Thanks, Kevin. Have a great day.
Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to the second hour of this evening's Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett going out over Revolution Radio. That's on the web at freedomslips.com. Go there and contribute if you can. Revolution Radio is the biggest and many would say the best of the listener-sponsored radio operations out there. So it's your support that keeps us going. Go to freedomslips.com and give generously. And while you're at it, if you want to join Truth Jihad Radio, you can just go to the Truth Jihad website, that's truthjihad.com, and sign up for three and some chump change a month. You'll get special access and free downloads to all my shows. I do a total of 5 hours of radio a week, bringing you great guests. That was an amazing interview with Scott Bennett. I wish we had more PSYOPs guys like him. And now we're going to move on to another great guest, talking still about 9/11 and the so-called war on terror from a slightly different perspective. We're talking with somebody who has been doing a slightly different kind of psychological operation since 9/11 in New York City. Les Jamison was the founder, I believe, leader at least for a while, of New York 9/11 Truth, and he's still at it. He's been leafleting the museum in New York City, that horrific Ground Zero 9/11 National Museum, the shrine of the big lie. And Les is out there handing out the AE 9/11 Truth Alternative Guide to the 9/11 Museum in the wake of these events. And there he is, Les Jamison. How are you?
Sound controls.
Hello, Les. How are you? Can you hear me, Les? I can see Les, but I can't hear him. Hello, Les. Maybe you need a mic. I can hear you. Hello.
Hello.
Okay. Got you now, Kevin?
Yeah. So, Les, you can turn off your video. We don't need the video, so you can save bandwidth. Just turn off your camera. There you go. And keep the volume down to avoid the echo, and we're all set.
Okay. Is my volume too high at the moment?
No, you're good.
Okay.
So, hey, this is great. It's been a while. I've worked with you over the years, and I saw that you're leading the effort to leaflet the 9/11 Museum with the alternative guide to 9/11. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, Kevin. First, thanks so much for inviting me on tonight. I would really look forward to catching you up here on the events going on here in New York City since last May. In the third week of May is when there was the official opening of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. And this, is a $700 million project that has been being built for a number of years and finally, was open to the public officially. And Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, knew this was coming about, and he and his team designed an alternative flyer or brochure to be handed out there, which is very important because there needed to be a piece of literature to counter the official museum brochure. So Richard came, and we did a press conference, and we had 4 days, Thursday through Sunday, where we flyered at the location there by the entrance to the Memorial Park. And it was quite something, very, very important effort that I could see happening. And right from the very first morning that it was open to the public at 9 a.m., you would not believe the crowds of people. Thousands and thousands of people pouring in to this memorial and this basically what is a tourist attraction slash Holocaust museum type of scenario here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's I would call it a kind of an idolatrous temple or a shrine of the big lie. You know, a false religion. It's actually a satanic deception that has kind of wormed its way into the God-shaped hole in people's hearts and minds that's been left by the receding of actual religion. And so now, you know, the sacred narrative of the Nazi Holocaust with all of its shrines and so-called Holocaust museums all over the world is, you know, basically, you know, pimping for genocide in Palestine. And likewise, this 9/11 museum, which is modeled after those, is a kind of idolatrous temple, a satanic, you know, spiritually nefarious site where people are essentially made even stupider and more evil than they already were before they came. So that's, yeah, I wrote a piece about this, I think, called the Shrine of the Big Lie. Mm-hmm. So I am very strongly supporting your getting out there and leafleting for truth.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't going to actually go into the museum myself because I knew it would just be repulsive to me. Yet Barbara Honecker begged me to go and take pictures and report to her what was there. So I did go into the museum, and I was just so overtaken. It's a huge monument to deception, to the official myth, and to the power of psychological operations, Kevin, especially when the elements of sorrow and memorialization and hero worship are used. Specifically, you know, you're overcome by the tragedy of the day and the horror of the day. They have audio recordings of the people in the buildings making the 911 calls or calls to their loved ones. There are artifacts, people's belongings, their shoes, their clothes, their handbags, firemen's artifacts, and so forth. You know, all these remnants of the tragedy. Then, of course, you see videos and images, some large images of the tragedy, whether it's the towers, you know, smoking and burning
and exploding.
Yes, yes. I was surprised actually. But that's later, okay, where you actually see the video of the towers being demolitioned. Because by that time, people are so overcome by the overwhelming trauma of the day that they have no clue what they're seeing. So it was quite an experience. I mean, Kevin, they even have photos where you go down a hallway and you go around this little wall, and there's a section where you see photos of the people jumping from the towers. You know, so I mean, they spared nothing in their design to overwhelm the audience here, the attendees, with, like I said, the horror and the tragedy of the day. And then to add to it, there's another element here which we need to be aware of, which is they have artifacts of the, like, various civic groups who made tributes to the families and the first responders, like quilts and flags and signs and various things, giving tribute to those who passed on that day, as well as the whole spirit of, you know, we came together, and the New Yorkers and the American people rose above the, you know, the tragedy, and, you know, we are the exceptional people who came together through it all, you know? So there's that element too that, is displayed in there. Then in terms of the, alternative research community, there's a little section, a little tiny wall where, you show, they show, some protesters, signs of, people protesting and wanting a real investigation, very small. And then right next to it, you see a the cover of the Popular Mechanics magazine.
Oh, boy. It's amazing how many people actually think that that Popular Mechanics piece answered the 9/11 research community.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, they just manufactured that in order to make that impression, because they know that most people aren't going to take the time to look into it carefully. And so just having the impression that, oh, well, there's a magazine out there that debunked all of this, that actually is good enough to work on a lot of people.
Right. A hobby magazine, right?
Right. Magazine taken over by a guy named Chertoff right before that issue came out. There was a coup d'etat at Popular Mechanics, and a certain, I think it was Benjamin Chertoff, was it, who became the head of that project. And he apparently may or may not be a cousin of Michael Chertoff, he's certainly from the same tribe.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just another indication how a few media pieces here that adhere to the official account are held to a higher level of esteem than all the scholars and scientists and physicists and architects and engineers. Come on, it's just ridiculous. But that is worth mentioning, that this is also a bit of the display in the museum. Then here's the huge revelation about the museum. The third tower that fell that day, Building 7, which wasn't even hit by a plane, is completely omitted.
Really? There's not like a little mock-up of Building 7 and a video of Larry Silverstein over and over saying about, you know, we made that decision to pull it and we watched the building collapse?
Go figure, right?
That should be the centerpiece of the whole museum.
You'd think, since they are supposedly so thorough and in their presentation and went through such, incredible efforts, extensive efforts for a number of years here to piece together the whole story, right?
Well, of course, if the 9/11 Commission can leave out Building 7 from its report, I suppose the museum can leave it out too, for the same reason.
Yes. And also there's a section in there that makes it very clear who they want the public to believe was responsible.
Radical Islam.
Bin Laden and these hijackers and so forth. Yeah.
Well, we knew that from the get-go. Like, you know, 2 seconds after the tower was hit, you know, all the newscasters were chanting, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden. So, hey.
Yeah, exactly. tried and convicted. And within 24 hours, these 19, flunky Arabs that were never even proven as far as their identities, and their names aren't even on the flight manifest, et cetera, but the museum has them.
Really? Well, you know, their families should come over here and sue, because there's not one shred of evidence that any of these guys were even on the planes, and there's essentially slam dunk proof that they weren't, because there are no authenticated passenger lists, there are no ticket stubs. There's no authentic video of any of them boarding any of these alleged attack planes. Right. 10 of them showed up alive after 9/11. One was dead a year before 9/11. The DNA has never been recovered. The government says they have DNA from all of the passengers, but none of the alleged hijackers. And when the hijackers' families begged the U.S. government to do DNA tests on them and to try and prove that their loved ones had actually been on those planes, the U.S. government said no. So I think we have a lawsuit here. And, you know, however much money this 9/11 museum has in its coffers, I think that that should be, that should go to pay lawyers and to pay the families of the people that they're falsely blaming.
Yeah, yeah, you know, very true words, Kevin. Furthermore, let's add the fact that, head of FBI at the time, Robert Mueller, was, asked on CNN twice, I believe, about the, issue that there was reports of several of the hijackers actually being alive. And, he had to admit he was forced to say, you know, we don't have definitive proof of their identities.
Yeah, he said we may never know, as I recall.
yeah. Geez. So that's not in the museum either. There's so many things. Oh, so here's an interesting thing. They do show pictures of the lobby in the destruction in the, I think it was the South Tower lobby, which was indication, if anybody knew what they were looking at, that you know, there were explosives. I mean, what caused that? It was definitely not a fireball going down the elevator shaft that could have done that, because the elevator shafts were staggered, and it would be physically impossible for that to occur. And, you know, furthermore, there wasn't even enough fire in the towers to do that to start with. But there are these photos of destruction within the lobbies. And so there's, you know.
Yeah, that's what Willie Rodriguez talks about that, too. He was there when some, you know, huge bombs went off in the basement, damaging the lobby. And that happened before whatever it was, the plane hit or whatever that thing was up above. You know, just about 10 seconds before that, boom, a huge explosion down in the sub-basements, badly injuring a bunch of people. So, yeah, it's interesting that they actually put a photo up of the damaged South Tower lobby in the museum.
Right, right. And so this is quite a phenomenon, Kevin, all in all, you know. And now let me move to the what's actually going on there in terms of the viewership. You know, again, there were thousands and thousands of people that day and that it opened, and every day since, thousands and thousands of people from all over the country and all over the world. Now, we've continued to flyer there just about every Saturday, and It's been an amazing experience, and you probably are aware. I've got a long history of doing outreach at Ground Zero, and I just am blown away by the experience. First of all, at this point, the receptivity to our flyers has been 99% positive. People are very open to receiving them. It's nicely done, very beautiful print job, and I say, as the crowds are coming by, I say more information on the collapse of the towers, or something like alternative research by architects and engineers on the collapse of the towers. So they're clear that what they're receiving is something different than what is being offered by the museum, okay?
I saw news reports that criticized you guys, claiming that you were deceiving people by making it look like you were handing out officially sanctioned museum literature, when in fact you were putting out conspiracy theories.
Right, right. Well, that was quite something. That actually occurred there, that, you know, just a few days before the opening. What happened? There were two media events. First, a Village Voice, right? The New York Village Voice put out an article saying that we were passing out fake flyers and deceiving the public. And that's a shocker in that, you know, the New York Village Voice is known to be a very radical newspaper.
Well, it used to be, but now it got bought up by the Zionists. So, anyway.
I believe it was taken over by Rupert Murdoch. Yep. So,
oh, did Murdoch owns it now?
I believe so, yes.
It's not just the Zionists then, it's the hardcore ultra-Zionist Fox News lunatics. Yeah.
It's an entirely different, media source. That's for darn sure. So, that was then followed by a hit piece by CNN's Jake Tapper. And, he interviewed a woman, Emily Bazelon, I believe her name is, who writes for Slate magazine, which I always thought to be a progressive publication, right? So.
Yeah, well, what does progressive mean these days, though? You know, they're foundation funded, corporate controlled mostly.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And, they're more centrist than anything. So, it was quite an interesting phenomenon. They got on air on CNN and said all kinds of things about what, this represented. And, so, that came out and caused a bit of a stir, but we were there anyway, and they've continued to be there. And again, it's been a very, very positive and productive experience because there's, you know, every time we're down there, we leave with a feeling that we just helped inform hundreds and hundreds of people that would not get this alternative research through any other means, because they come from around the country where there's just no news and no access. They just would never be introduced.
And it's a perfect place to introduce them because they're interested in 9/11 at that moment. I mean, if you go to people who are watching a football game at your local bar or something, they might say, oh, well, 9/11, I just want to watch the football game. Or, you know, you catch them on the street or what have you, they're going about their business. But they're descending upon the 9/11 museum. They're focused on 9/11. They're going to spend some time, deeply, you know, emotively affected by 9/11. And so that's the perfect time to hand them this flyer.
Absolutely. It's the most appropriate location I can think of. That's why we're there. And another part of the experience I like to share is the observation of the crowds of people. They come in often huge tour groups or civic groups visiting New York or just coming to the museum. Sometimes we see school groups. Young people went, oh, I just love handing them the materials because, they're young and, usually pretty open-minded and, are at the stage where they really need to get their minds open to this and have a whole life ahead of them that where they need to be aware. And, sometimes we get firemen's groups from around the country visiting the city and, visiting the memorial, and you know, the whole sense of it is people are coming in by the thousands is they're like on a pilgrimage to this, this sacred space, where they are just hungry to experience and have their own experience of the, this horrific event that happened where they can see, feel, and touch, what they know occurred in this country and in this city. And, it's like, it is like a very sacred, cathartic experience. It's, a deeply emotional thing that they want to have in their life and, something that I know that they'll remember forever. And that's the whole sense of this, of what I get from people. And what's interesting is sometimes, hundreds of people will pass by and not one will take a flyer. Then all of a sudden, hundreds will pass by and you can't give them out fast enough. It's really something to watch the group think, you know?
Yeah, I've had that experience too, doing 9/11 teach-ins, that once one person takes whatever it is you're giving them, suddenly they all want it. But right. If nobody's taking it, then everybody's afraid to be the only one who's taking it.
Yes, yes, yes. There's an awful lot of that. So, But again, every time we're there, we hand out many hundreds of flyers. And I would just like to say to anybody listening from the New York metro area, New Jersey, Connecticut, if you'd like to participate, please get in touch with me. You can email me at I have a email, les@ae911truth.org. That's les@ae911truth.org. And please get in touch and come on and join in.
Well, I'll go ahead and post that at the radio blog so people who want to email Les and get involved in leafleting at the 9/11 Museum can just go to truthjihad.com and click on the radio link, and you'll find the Les Jamison show, and just look there. You should be able to find his email. Well, hey, Les, we have a call in. We had a request to call in. And so, listeners, if you do want to call into this live show, what you need to do is contact me ahead of time and give me your Skype handle, and that's the way we can do call-ins. And so tonight we are going to do our first call-in using that method. Stacy is calling from, well, I'm not sure. Let's ask her. Stacy, where are you calling from? Hello, Stacy. Well, we should have Stacy here. Hello, Stacy, come in. Going once, going twice. This is your chance. Oh, boy, my first call-in, and it's not working. Stacy? Hey, Stacy, there you are. How are you doing?
Good, how are you? I can't see you. I guess you just have that one picture of you?
Well, this is radio, so we don't have to see each other.
Okay.
So I have Les Jamison on the line. He's been talking about organizing, handing out leaflets at the 9/11 Museum in New York, which I think is a very noble activity and absolutely necessary. So what's your take on the way 9/11 has been taken and, you know, turned into this kind of hollow idol that everybody is supposed to bow to, and, you know, in the schools and the institutions, they bow to it, but it's hollow. Everybody kind of senses there's something wrong, and worldwide, the world knows it was an inside job. I saw a poll recently, 2/3 of Chinese people, 80% of Muslims know it was an inside job, and 90% of Germans in a poll a few years ago showed they didn't believe the official story. And in the U.S., as many as 86%, I think it was, didn't completely believe the government, thought that the government was not telling the full truth. So it's a really weird situation. What do you think, Stacey?
Well, who do you think did it?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I know who did it. It was the simple, vague way to describe them would be the Bush crime family and the neoconservative Zionists.
Okay, but... So Israel, I mean, who did 9/11 with Israel?
Yeah, not quite that simple, but yeah, I think the Israeli Mossad, as Alan Sabrowski says, probably was involved as an agency. You know, Sabrowski is the former strategic studies director at the U.S. Army War College, and he said that 9/11 was complex enough it had to have been done by one of just a handful of intelligence organizations. And he said the CIA wouldn't do it as an agency. You know, they wouldn't make that their project as an official CIA project. And therefore, really, the only one that could have done it was Mossad. Now, obviously, it wasn't just Mossad by itself. Rather, they had won over a whole team of people at the top of the U.S. command chain, Dick Cheney being the most obvious, but also, you know, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Rumsfeld, right. General Myers, et cetera, et cetera.
So is this, are we live? Is this a live show?
Yes, we're going out live. So who do you think did 9/11, Stacey?
Well, Israel did. And that's, you know, the important thing is that because this is the problem, this is why it's 14 years later, because people keep saying, oh, it's a very difficult thing to resolve. Israel is the one that did it. And we need to, in all the, from all the players within our government that are Israeli dual citizenship, are the responsible ones. They love to blame it on Bush. They love to blame it on Cheney. Now, those people are ignorant, and they deserve to be, you know, prosecuted as well because of their ignorance and stupidity. I mean, Bush, the one thing is that Bush, one of the comments he made is he said, I'd like to know how that guy actually accomplished flying a plane into the Pentagon. So you could, with a remark like that, you could clearly tell that Bush was a very ignorant and easily betrayed person. Like he just like Hillary Clinton, you know, like there's certain people that are like they've been deceived from the people that surround them that try to present a certain issue. 911, then this is the problem. Like, we have a lot of people out there, and there's a lot of people that are not truthful because they want to say, oh, it's this agency and this agency. It's Israel, and it's the Israeli dual citizens in our country that caused 911.
Well, I think there is a fair amount of evidence pointing in that direction. Les, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to go on the record as saying that we have to be held to the highest of standards. You realize that because of the controversial nature of this topic, number one.
Wait, what do you mean, though? See, this is what we start getting into problems when
Let me finish, Stacey.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What I'm saying here is as a movement trying to achieve something which is unprecedented, which is justice and accountability for a treasonous act,
mm-hmm.
Okay, we have to be as strategic and tactical and savvy as possible from a political standpoint. What that means is, let me just finish here, is that any accusations or allegations of actual blame, you better have facts in place.
I want to make a comment because, like, can you see me, Kevin, or is it no?
No, this is just radio. We don't have the visuals.
Okay, well, I want to just share with you because I want to introduce something actually how this was accomplished, because one plane actually was used, not four planes. And if you add up all the passengers from all four planes, you can put them all onto one plane. So this is what was really done. And there was a lot of passengers on the passenger list that were Jewish or Israeli, but they might be American, but American Jewish, whatever. So they were all part of this game. And what took place is that they I don't know if you guys have, like, Kevin, if you've studied this extensively, but the pilot John Ogonowski, that was for the pilot for Flight 11.
No, I don't recall studying him. What about him?
No, okay, so, well, John Ogonowski, he was the pilot for Flight 11. He was one of the pilots, and there was a lot of controversy because they couldn't, when they were doing investigation, they couldn't figure out why this man, because usually pilots can call in and they can say, okay, I want this job, I want this job. And he actually didn't want that flight, but somehow it was like the higher beats or whatever. They said, people couldn't figure out why he was like, he had to beat that flight, right? Well, if you have to look at John Ogonowski, you need to take a look at his picture, okay? And then take a look at Daniel Lewin, the guy that was on Flight 11. This is very, very important because I actually almost lost my life from Mossad because I was researching and I was paying a lot of attention into Daniel Lewin. And I was really and I was in my own house. I wasn't talking to anyone about this. And this goes to show you the extent of why they are looking inward at people, because they want to make sure that the people that actually are looking into their crimes, that they knock off. And these people actually did try to knock me off. So
what was the connection between the pilot and Lewin? And for listeners who don't know who Lewin was, he was a crack Israeli special forces guy who was on Flight 11, right?
Yeah, and he was trained. He could actually fly. He could fly planes. And so what I'm going to tell you the secret was how they actually pulled this off is they took out Ogonowski before he probably got to the airport. A Mossad agent took him out. Gave all his credentials to Daniel Lewin, because you need to take both of these pictures side by side, and these two are like, they look identical. So if this Daniel Lewin put on his flight, his captain's suit or whatever, and to go into the airport, and he basically went as John Oganowski. So he was already, so the way they pulled it off.
Why did he have to be on the passenger list to do that?
No, what I'm saying is, you had a pilot, right, Kevin?
If this guy is going to impersonate the pilot, I don't see why it's going to help to put him on the passenger list.
Put who on? Well, because you need, the reason is because remember how there was, no one could understand why there was no code given out for a hijack. There was no, like, break into, like, how, people always wonder, how did they get into the cockpit, right?
That's apparently, all four planes, that was a mystery.
The reality of it was, and there was another guy that, was a, one thing you have to remember, you supposedly had four planes, but really there weren't. There was only one plane used. That plane landed in Cleveland for the bomb threat. And then the people, Jewish people, because if you look at the passenger list, and you know what the thing that's important to say? These people are still alive. Daniel Lewin's alive and well and living in Tel Aviv, or, gone through surgery and is living wherever, but he is alive.
Well, do you have evidence for that?
Well, like I said, this is how this whole thing went down.
Okay, Stacey, it sounds somewhat plausible that the first loose change, of course, went over that business of the, exact same number of passengers being unloaded at the Nassau facility at Cleveland Airport as should have been on all four planes, which is a ridiculously low number for all four planes. So that's been out there for a while. But do you have a question for Les? Because, Les is the guest and we only have 20 minutes left with him.
Right. Well, I mean, Les, I'm just saying, I went online and watched your, I think if anyone is representing a 911 truth movement, that, I watched, you were being interviewed and, I didn't hear you once say it was Israel.
So let's ask Les, why is that? Okay, well, thank you, Stacey. I appreciate the call in. We're going to turn to Les and say, Les, why, when you hand out the leaflet, why doesn't the leaflet say Israel did it?
Okay, I'm glad to respond to that. First of all, the term, when Israel did it, connotes, the connotation is the entire population of Israel.
Good point.
Perpetrated the crime. No, I mean, it's like saying when you say the U.S. government did something or was involved in 9/11, obviously, the entire government.
Well, it wasn't your uncle who works for the IRS.
Exactly, or the people, involved in the Department of Agriculture or, any such agency. No, there's a tiny faction of people at the top of the security state, the military-industrial secrecy complex. Yes, you have to point to them, absolutely. And as far as Mossad, questioning of Mossad involvement, very valid. But again, what is the documented proof that we have? I think the strongest that is documented is the quote, dancing Israelis, and the fact that these Israelis that were part of, a moving company and some art students were then rounded up by the FBI and shipped back to Israel and no real questioning.
One of them even said on Israeli TV that, quote unquote, we were only there to document the event, suggesting that the reason that they were there set up to film the plane crashes, presumably, and demolitions was that someone had sent them there to document it who knew it was coming.
Exactly. So there's an awful lot there that can be pursued. Now, the next question is, if you're truly seeking to get to the root and pinpoint who is responsible, how do you follow that trail and get definitive evidentiary proof that is admissible in a court of law? That's where we have to pursue and, point ourselves to in terms of the way that this can actually be prosecuted. Now, otherwise, with people on the internet and doing the research and making blanket statements here in an attempt to prosecute the crime, I think, can be more damaging than it is helpful unless you can point to the definitive document of proof that we can use as factual evidence in our moving forward here as a movement in an attempt to get a full-blown exposure of the facts leading to the full realization that we've been lied to about 9/11, and we want truth and justice on the legal in the legal arena, which is a great segue to another topic here that I think really has to be looked at and understood by the 9/11 truth movement, which is the fact that in Congress, here, you know, right now, H.R. 428 is a resolution that's been introduced by Congressman Walter Jones and Democratic Congressman Steve Lynch. It's H.R. 428, and there are 17 co-sponsors in Congress. And what this is all about is a move to release 28 redacted pages from the Senate Joint Inquiry. Now, this report preceded the 9/11 Commission investigation. And this is, I think, highly relevant and could lead to an entire broad-scale, full exposure of the questions of 9/11. Here's why. Because in what's intimated in these redacted pages is that there was funding by Saudi Arabia and participation by, quote, other governments and U.S. agencies.
Wow. That, yeah, isn't that amazing that Bush got away with classifying that?
Absolutely. And now let's explain another issue here. With after 13 years now, these congressmen are saying there's nothing in these pages that can be deemed necessary for national security. And even Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton, who were co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, are making public statements that they should be declassified and everything else should be declassified. Now, picture this, folks. Imagine then declassifying the testimony of Sybil Edmonds and William Rodriguez.
Sounds good to me.
That's what we can lead to through this whole process and through usage of the statements of the 9/11 commissioners themselves. You see, that's where we can make headway on the political level, where we can go toe-to-toe to any media person and make these statements and use the position of the 9/11 Commission members, as well as 9/11 families who are behind this effort, as well as the statements by these congressmen who are stating, here's the three reasons why the 28 pages should be redacted, declassified, and revealed. Number one, because it's right for the issue of transparency. This is an issue of government transparency, which is necessary to have a truthful, functional democracy. Number two, because the 9/11 family members deserve to know what's in those pages. And number three, because it's actually the information has an impact on national security today, meaning all this chaos and turmoil and military action going on in the Middle East and Iraq and Syria now, specifically this, quote, ISIS uprising, it's all impacted by what's in these pages.
Well, it sounds like the same people who were involved in funding 9/11 are in many ways the people funding ISIS, the deep state, you know, the drug dealing wing of the CIA, namely the Bush crime family, and the so-called U.S. allies or U.S. puppets in the Gulf, some of the local agents of the U.S. empire, and basically they're the friends of U.S. and Israel in the Gulf, and their safari club tied in with this international deep state. I think those are essentially the people behind 9/11 and the people that are funding ISIS. You know, I just talked in the first hour with a former PSYOPs, U.S. Army PSYOPs specialist, Scott Bennett, who was fairly high level, and he agrees. He got chased out because he was looking at where the financing was coming from for these so-called terrorist groups. And Dov Zakheim, the guy who was in charge of the Pentagon finances on 9/11, who misplaced $2.3 trillion, apparently didn't appreciate that. And so Scott got into a fight with Dov Zakheim and ended up being prosecuted on some totally bogus, you know, wrong paperwork kind of thing. So bottom line here is that the whole terror scare is it's all being financed by these dubious actors, and it looks like those 28 pages less could possibly lead to the exposure of some of these people, because even if it's mostly pointing at certain Saudis, those people are going to start ratting out the others if we go after them.
Yeah, I would agree, Kevin, and here's what I see, is that if these pages... okay, here's the first objective. The rest of the congressmen, so far 17 people within Congress have read the 28 pages because they have the access to read the pages. They just call the House Intelligence Committee and request access to read what's in these pages. So what we need to do, and I'm involved, by the way, in a initiative here to pressure the members of Congress to take this action. Number one, read the pages. It's very significant because those who have already read those pages are making some very powerful statements. Let me just read this to you. Representative Stephen Lynch says, the 28 pages show the extensive advance planning before 9/11, and he alludes to collaboration between other governments, not just Saudi Arabia, and government agencies. Representative Walter Jones said, if the 9/11 hijackers had outside help, particularly from one or more foreign governments, the press and public have a right to know what our government has or has not done to bring justice to the perpetrator. Thomas Massey says, I went into the soundproof secret room here in Congress and read those 28 pages, and it was a really disturbing event for me to read those. I had to stop every two or three pages and rearrange my perception of history. And goes on to say, it certainly changes your view of the Middle East. We need to declassify those 28 pages. So imagine if we can get as many members of Congress to read those pages, I think that'll be a huge accomplishment. And second, we need to pressure them to co-sponsor the legislation and pressure them to vote in favor of it. And then we need to pressure the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and I believe the Majority Leader, whose name is, I believe, James McCarthy, to allow it to go to the floor for a vote. So that's the process.
Now, would this vote, or rather this bill, mandate the declassification or just urge Obama to declassify it?
No, it would mandate it.
Okay.
Yeah, it would mandate it. Now, speaking of Obama, guess what? He promised 9/11 family member Bill Doyle, who has spearheaded the family lawsuit against the Saudi government for the money trail that that has been basically disclosed here. And Obama promised Bill Doyle that he would make sure that those 20 pages would be declassified and released. Well, guess what? Then Obama has obviously reneged on that promise.
Well, didn't Obama say he was going to close Guantanamo and end the wars and all that nice stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of late in his term.
that ran out of steam for whatever reason. But, you know, I think, okay, yeah, closing Guantanamo, that should have happened for sure. Now, with these 28 pages, all he has to do is, you know, make the ruling or the executive order. You know, it's not complicated for him to do. He could do it tomorrow. And he has not. He's reneged. And, you know, we can pretty strongly speculate here that, of course, his handlers and the, you know, those in with the power in the intelligence and security agency and the military industrial complex are definitely tying up his hands on that. And he's got no room to follow through. Absolutely not. So this effort, HR 28, is quite something to watch. Now, I would urge people to go. There's a website called 28pages.org. This is put up by a 9/11 family member, 28pages.org. You can get a lot of background there. There's been some mainstream coverage of this, which is quite something. There's been an article in the New Yorker magazine, and also counterpunch.org. There's an article by James Ridgway. WhoWhatWhy.org. There's a great article. I believe it's by Russ Baker on the issue of this resolution is what it is. And so it's very interesting. And I think this is something very new and unprecedented for the movement to see an action actually occurring within Congress that we can use to pressure elected officials. And here's what I'm proposing, and many others are part of an effort here within the movement here that we're organizing around, which is to write letters to our congressmen, number one, to read the pages.
Now, can they just go into that soundproof room and read the pages, or do they need to do anything like get a classification level or something first?
No, they don't need any classification level. They have access. All they need to do is make the request to the House Intelligence Committee. So also, before we run out of time, I want to give one other website that's being worked on that will have much more detail on this. It is I'll give it to you in a second here.
Okay, yeah, the first one you mentioned was 28pages.org.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. A lot of good stuff there. And we're going to have more detail on. Here it is. It's 911truthoutreach.org/declassify-28pages. I'll repeat that. 911truthoutreach.org/declassify-28pages. This will be up, 2 days from now, on Sunday, October the 12th. You can look for it any point thereafter. And it's quite fascinating. I hope people get behind this. And again, this I just want to stress, this is not a, quote, limited hangout. This is an action that can lead to the unraveling of the full spectrum of 9/11 issues. And you know, we were talking about all the people visiting the 9/11 Museum from around the country and around the world. There's so many who were still in this sort of, you know, just hypnotized by the trauma of 9/11. They will get a whole new understanding because this is going to hit the media on a much higher level. And these are the people we need to reach. And
okay, well, I appreciate you helping deprogram these people, Les. We hit the end of the hour. Thank you, Les Jamison. You've been with New York 9/11 Truth and now working with AE911Truth.org, handing out their flyers at the museum. I'll put those links up at the Truth Jihad website. That's truthjihad.com. Go to the radio link. And once again, thanks, Les Jamison. Appreciate your great work.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Bye.
Good night.